This episode of Unfiltered is brought to you by Google Gemini. U.S. college students get Gemini's Pro plan free for 1 year and use the best model in the world for multimodal understanding. So whether you're uploading a video to get feedback on your presentation, uploading a photo of your homework to ask for extra help, or transcribing notes from a lecture you missed, Gemini 3 Pro can help. I'm honestly so happy and excited for all the college students out there because I wish this was around back when I was in school. This is such a game changer and so useful. I'm honestly a little jealous. So if you want to try it out, sign up to get more access to Google's most accurate model, Gemini 3 Pro. Unlimited image uploads, pro-level image editing, higher limits in Notebook LM, Gemini in Gmail and Docs, 2 terabytes of storage, and more. All you have to do is visit gemini.google/students to learn more and sign up. Terms apply.
So as soon as I got on the top bunk, man, I hear tension on that, scramble, scramble, scramble. Boom, you know, hit the ground, and I sprint to the helicopter. We get there, we take off. I think it was 3 to 5 minutes. We get airborne, and then we get there, and then basically the JTAC said he wanted the close air support with a 50 cal rescue helicopter, which is rare. And there was those 12 guys in the tree line. And before we could land on this dirt road, there were still tracers going both ways. We had to suppress the enemy in 3 or 4 gun patterns. We had 2 aircraft, 2 guns each, all rounds on the target, and 3 or 4 gun runs. And
hey guys, welcome back to part 2 of this week's episode with Anthony Dyer. You can see me smiling here because I'm loving this interview. I've always been fascinated by military things, and I've read about the C-130 Spectre gunships, and you hear the stories. But here's a man who actually flew on one as a gunner, and we're going to get into more stories about some of the things they did. But it's just truly, truly fascinating. So Anthony, thank you so much for coming back for part 2.
Thank you, Steve. It's an honor and a privilege to be here. I appreciate it.
Thank you, brother. So we don't want to waste a lot of time here, because if you don't know who Anthony is, go listen to part 1. Then you'll know. All right. First thing I want to ask you about today is, in your book, you make reference. And by the way, everybody, this is his book, Moonchild. And it's actually more than that. It's Moonchild, The Roots and Wings of a USAF Combat Special Missions Aviator. That's what Anthony was here. And we'll talk a little bit more here at the end of this episode about his book. But in your book, you make reference to something you call it house money life. What does that mean? What is all that about?
Yeah, so a house money life is like, you know, if you've ever been to a casino, like how much more aggressively and chances would we take if we were playing with a house's money? So basically it's risk taking. And I heard a quote the other day, and it was like, empires are built on taking risks. 9-to-5s are built on avoiding them. And I'll take it a step further, and I like to say that I realized at a young age that you can't take anything with you when you pass. There's no U-Haul behind a hearse, that whole saying. That the only thing you can truly leave is your legacy, how you're remembered. So to do that, I always believe that there's some risk taken with that. You know, you have to get out of your comfort zone, take chances, see the world. That basically that saying, that quote gave me that boost of confidence to take chances and just believe at the end of the day that it's going to make me somehow a better person, better man, and I can leave that footprint. So
I loved it. I had never heard that saying before. House money life, but you're playing with the house's money.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the thing is, you're going in a casino, the house always wins. They got to stay in business. Yeah. If they lost money, they wouldn't be in business, right?
Oh, yeah.
A lot of people don't understand that.
What was the beginning of that movie, Casino, where De Niro's, he said, it's all been arranged to get your money, you know? That's just very true thing people forget about, you know?
Yep. Yeah, it is. So, all right. So now, one of the stories that I read in the book, and you and I talked briefly about yesterday in a pre-call, or day before yesterday, I guess it was now, is a story in there about Waffle Man. Who's Waffle Man?
Yeah. So we, what would happen on the AC-130 gunship? We would land at Bagram. We usually had to be down before the sun came up, what we call before morning nautical twilight. And we would land, and it was about breakfast time. And that was my favorite meal of the day. And we would always go there, and there was somebody usually cooking you an omelet to your liking. And there was the guy that made waffles, and I just remember this guy would he would just look at us with this, you just know the look when someone hates your presence, right? Like, just that level of just hate, you know, real menacing looking character, man. And so we ended up getting this big shoot one night, and these guys were, you know, had discus and RPGs again, shooting at another Green Beret team or ODA team. And basically we ended up, you know, killing them all. And I was on the 105, and it, I if I remember, I think he was the last guy we'd got. But so 2 weeks goes by, we're like, man, where's the, you know, the waffle man? Like, you know, he may have been a dick man, but I enjoyed his waffles, you know, and he made good waffles till he didn't. Come to find out, this, he was a third country national that, you know, those guys could get on and off base. And, you know, so I don't know if he did get vetted as well. You wonder how that happens. And there was a barrage of mortars leading up to those 2 weeks that were getting closer and closer. And I remember one even hit the mailroom. And so come to find out, this guy was with the Taliban and supporting them and stuff like that, almost like a spy type thing. And yeah, we're at the talk near the smoke pit there, and the ODA team comes up. I'm like, hey, just so you guys know, you guys smoked a waffle man the other night. You know, like, holy crap, man. Like, how did this guy get on bait? All this stuff going through your head. So, but yeah, he made good waffles till he didn't.
More importantly, now who's going to make the waffles?
Yeah, they had him replaced. May have even been an active duty person they replaced him with. But yeah, that was a very interesting thing, and something you wouldn't expect to happen.
Well, you know, you remember, and I made reference yesterday to the movie The Green Beret with John Wayne, I think came out back in the 70s. And you saw the North Vietnamese spies, I guess is what you'd refer to them as, and they're walking off distances between buildings and the front gate and things like that. And turns out they were measurements that they would give to the mortar operators to launch mortars into the base. And that's happening then. And then here we are 50 years later. And it's still happening. You'd think there's got to be some serious vetting going on to let these foreign nationals in.
Yeah, and that was the first thing I remember thinking about, was that whole vetting process. And you know, it really, there's always the saying, "Watch what you say outside the walls." You know, the talking. That, I mean, that really holds true, because you know, the last thing you want to know is let somebody like that know where the gunship guys are, or the operators are, you know, stuff like that. But yeah, it worked out though. Where, you know, that guy's not with us no more. And couldn't get us no more.
So you guys were flying out of Bagram. When you landed, did they put those planes in hangars so people could not see them?
No, honestly, we didn't, man. They were in there was basically us and then the 160th guys. And like, we had our own ramp, and there was these barriers all around it and stuff like that, you know? So from the outside of the gate looking in, unless you were extremely elevated, you know, you wouldn't be able to see the gunship, you know?
And you mentioned in your, conversation just a second ago about discus. Can you explain to our listeners what a disc is?
Yeah, it's basically the same thing as like a, I compare it to a 50 cal, you know, machine gun. You know, it's a fully automatic weapon that is a 12.7 millimeter that for whatever reason the enemy often has, you know. And you know, I've been to East Africa, they had it, and I've been to fought the Taliban and ISIS, and they all had it. So,
and that's typically those are the ones you see mounted on the back of the pickup trucks over there, is that right?
Yeah. What we call a technical, usually it'd be like some form of like Hilux truck with one of those on it or something like that. And Hilux is basically, if you think about a Tacoma type Toyota truck.
Yeah. It's amazing how many of those little trucks they have.
Oh, yeah. Everywhere, man. those things would go anywhere, too, man. I tell you.
After I retired from DEA, I did a DOD contract, and we worked for the Office of Military Commissions. And most of it's classified that I can't talk about, but we had access to classified reporting coming out of Iraq. And it was amazing how many of these little trucks, what'd you call them? Technicals. They were destroying, and they were like a swarm of bees. They just kept showing up.
Oh yeah. Wow. Those things are indestructible, almost like cockroaches or something, you know, and then for whatever reason, the enemy always had that, and you know, and AKs and stuff like that, and even RPGs, you know.
Till a 40 millimeter or 105 millimeter hits them.
Very true, yeah.
Runs their day.
Oh, yeah.
So you're based in Bagram. I mentioned to you the other day that I had done just a short TDY over in Afghanistan, and we went to Bagram for some briefings and meetings over there. I got to tell you, the food there was excellent.
Yeah, I enjoyed it, man. Like, I remember Fridays we would have steak and surf and turf type things, sometimes even lobster and crab legs, depending on the day. But yeah, I remember like there was these things we called mermites. We'd be flying in from an op, and what it was the guys that were not flying that night would get you chow on these big crate type things and try to keep it warm for you. And I remember like we had it down to a T, man, where like someone would reach back to the talk and go, hey, what's on the mermites? And the Evo back then would tell us all. And excuse me, then like Wednesdays they had like chicken tenders, and Fridays, like I said, was a surf and turf. And then there was even a pizza day that they made at one point. I think it was like goat cheese or something like that. It was terrible. But other than that, man, I enjoy most of it, you know. So,
yeah. Well, you know, it goes a long way taking care of your troops like that. just not, you want to eat healthy, but also it's a little bit of a memory from home, I guess.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And it's little things like, you know, we would radio back and see what a game scored, a NFL game was or something like that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Things that we're used to.
Oh yeah.
That we're used to and you're not. How long were you based out there in Bagram?
So I did, I believe it was double digit numbers there to Bagram. And the thing about being an aviator in combat is like, usually like on the gunship, right? There's for every 90 days, you could hit 330 hours and that was it. They had to, if you exceed that, they had to sit you down for, but if you wanted to fly, there'd be some big general signing a big waiver for you. So it rarely happened. So we would do not at the time, 90 days on, 90 days off, 90 days on, 90 days off. And so I think I reached 9 or 10 of those there to Bagram. So 3 months at a time, you know? And I remember Admiral McRaven actually changed the ops tempo because he was at the one point the USOCOM commander, and he's like, "Hey guys, the ace model gunship's going away." He's like, "But as far as combat, you guys are still going to be deploying on a different." He's getting on a different gunship, and basically like, but he did make the dwell time, so we would do like 90 days on, and you'd get at least 6 months off to mitigate some of that, especially winding down the global war on terror. Like there was guys I flew with, man, they spent half their adult life in Afghanistan. It seemed like.
Mm-hmm. Well, during your downtime, did you have to stay in country? Did you go on R&R back to the States? What happened?
Yeah. So after the 90 days that you would come back and you would get 2 weeks of, downtime, you know, R&R. And then right after the 2 weeks, you know, by that time, especially when it was 90 on, 90 off, you're already getting ready to go for the next trip. So you're getting your currencies, your live fires, your engagements, your SEER refresher. There's so many. I think at one point I had like some items I had to keep up with, you know, just to deploy, right?
And that's back here in the States, right?
Yeah, yeah. Back in the States, you get all your training done and all that good stuff. So,
jeez. But the aircraft, they don't get a break, do they?
No. I used to tell people, if it wasn't leaking, we ain't flying. You know, it was one of those type things. You bring a red rag with it, you know, so you could wipe up the red hydraulic fluid and it didn't look as bad. Just that mental break you sort of give yourself, you know. So.
When did you come out of Afghanistan? What year do you remember?
So my last, it was right before the ISIS thing kicked off. I think my last Afghanistan trip was on the AC-130 Whiskey model, and that was 2014-ish, if I remember right there.
And where did you go next?
So basically what happened was the ISIS, you know, during that deployment kicked off, and basically we had, you know, two gunship crews, and I remember a bunch of ruffling going outside, and at that point they had moved us from the old B huts, these wooden plywood huts, to the dorms. And I hear people like packing bags. Like, what is going on? So I walk out there and it's early, you know, and basically the ISIS thing had been enough, elevated as a threat enough for us to send a crew out there. And we, you know, we sent that crew to Kuwait. And then, I mean, they were there forever. I don't know, 6-8 months, something like that. Cause I'd already got back from Afghanistan and getting ready to go by the time they had got back. You know? So it was a long run for those guys. You know, I remember the guys that got the first kills on ISIS and stuff like that, and aircraft 1308. And just 1 minute they're flying with you in Afghanistan, next minute they're in Kuwait getting ready to fly over Iraq and Syria. So,
no rest for the weary, huh?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. And then 2015 was my next my ISIS trip there.
And before we get into that, when you would come back to the States and you've got all these your additional training you got to keep up with and refreshers and continuing educations, I guess what you'd call it, did that include any therapy?
So it was one of those things that I'll be honest, what I did was I brushed it under a rug, you know, and I would say what I needed to say to keep flying. There's this, you'd go to the flight dock and they'd ask you the questions like, "Hey, how much are you drinking?" And, you know, and I would say like 3 or something like that. And then I would be like, "Oh, how are you doing mentally?" "I'm doing good. No thoughts of this and that." "Okay, I'm still fine. I'm good." I was putting a band-aid on this thing. And basically what I'm getting at is I didn't want to be the guy to get taken off the flying schedule. You know, there's this thing, a flight dock. Basically, it's the same thing as if you give a ground guy a do not arm. It's the same thing as a flyer. If you give him a duties not to include flying, what we call the NIF. But yeah, you did what you had to do to stay in the air. And then, but yeah, it's like I said, I wish I'd have took that tactical knee then, not picked up the bottle of alcohol, things like that. But yeah, so I definitely put a band-aid on it, and I should have done it earlier. So,
well, hindsight's 20/20, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So now, and we'll get more into that too after we, because you got some great stories here. So you go to Kuwait and you're appointed as the senior director of operations targeting ISIS. What does all that mean?
Yeah, so basically it's a fancy way of saying an enlisted aviator that was taking care of the enlisted air crew. And you're monitoring like your flight hours, you know, if their air conditioning goes out, the HVAC guys, I mean, that's who you ride with one of five shells downrange. You know, you want the air conditioning constantly going, stuff like that. You're just basically taking care of the people, and then you would step in and fly with them, make sure they're doing okay. But basically a leadership management type, but it's just a tech artist. Same time, the same rank as a lot of these guys, but you are like, you know, being your brother's keeper, checking on him.
Does that mean you're not flying?
Not flying as much at that point. So I did once a week was what was allowed, because what would happen, you'd be the enlisted guy, then you would have like a lieutenant colonel, and they were the commander. You make sure their intents met, and then you'd be the enlisted guy as the bridge.
Did you volunteer for that, or you were selected for it?
A little both. It was offered to me, and then I was like, yeah, I want to get back. I want to get in this ISIS fight. I always wanted to do something and to get in the fight more and more. And then I did that, and then this guy worked it out where I could do it, and it went by really fast. Probably the busiest I've ever been was all just the logistical part of all that stuff. It was a lot.
Well, you want to take care of your brothers too, because oh, yeah. You know, they're the ones out there in the way of danger and harm's way, as they say. And it's just a brotherhood thing again.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And it's not like, I tell people, it's not if, it's when it would happen. I mean, I remember like a guy towards AC had to go home. So I had to fly a lot more then this other lady got sent home for another reason. Then, yeah, just things that you name, it'll happen downrange if and when you have to step in and sort of fill that gap.
At some point you came out of the C-130s and you took on a new adventure. How did that happen? And what is it you went into?
So I always wanted to be a traditional, like a Vietnam era, like door gunner, you know. So at this point, the Air Force had combined the Loadmaster flight engineer and the aero gunner, and basically made a Swiss Army knife in the sky, what we call today a special missions aviator. And that was on the gunship. And on the helicopter, all they did was they added flight engineer and aero gunner together to make a special missions aviator. And I was like, man, I want to be a traditional, where the term the whole nine yards comes from, is like Vietnam, where they had 9 yards of ammunition left in their belt, and, you know, about to Winchester. That type of gunner. And so, yeah, I was like, man, like, I want to test my mettle. I never felt like I'd done enough. And so I joined the Jolly Greens there, the 41st Rescue Squadron at Moody Air Force Base after about probably 8 months of training on that. And just the Jolly Greens, man, it was 4 years of my career, maybe five. Very, very noble men and women, and probably the best professional aviators I ever had a chance to fly with. And you fly with Pararescue, man, and those guys are the very best in the world at what they do.
From what I know about those folks, that's an understatement. The heroic things that they do, going in under fire, staying on the ground, the fact that you're bringing a helicopter in under fire and then trying to get off the ground before it blows up.
Oh, yeah.
Whew. I mean, that just takes a big set of stones. It's unbelievable. So now you're in the combat search and rescue unit.
Yeah. The mighty 41st Rescue Squad and the Jolly Greens there. And you have the, like I said, the Jolly Green heritage is huge. There's the stories of Vietnam where how the Green Feet came to be was they would land in these rice paddies and they would be in and out, rescue a guy so fast that by the time they lifted the helicopters up, it would look like two green footprints around the rice paddies. And that's where the Green Feet comes from. And those guys are awesome. And they work hard and they party hard. I'll say that.
Well, you got to do something to relieve that tension, that stress, and that anxiety.
Oh yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and it goes back to something too, like those PJs and like those guys, all those, even the aviators, man, there's something different in those guys' DNA, man. In my opinion, man, they're the very best of the Air Force, you know, and it goes back to that, what makes them different to run in these situations where there's trace of fire both ways and to save their brothers and sisters, you know, and while everybody else is just not in the fight. I always looked up to those guys, always will.
There, when I used to work in DEA Special Operations Division, and our big boss, I was his, they call him executive assistant. I called it a butt boy for him, but his name was Derek Maltz. He's kind of legendary in DEA, and still to this day is, especially when it comes to fighting fentanyl. But he had a brother who was a PJ that was killed in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And Derek went to Afghanistan as a DEA supervisor at one point for whatever reason. And they surprised him while he was there, and they flew him out on some helos to the spot where his brother died. And he was allowed to lay a reef, and you know they're out in Indian territory. It wasn't safe, but yeah. I mean, what a great recognition! And so Derek came back, and created what he calls the Maltz Challenge. M-A-L-T-Z is his last name. And if you're curious about that, it's a several step physical, annual physical challenge. And if you complete it, you're a stud. I mean, it's very challenging, but he does that annually. You know, the funds, they use the funds there that are raised to support military, especially those going through traumatic incidents, SEAL and PTSD and so forth. So check it out, Maltz Challenge. What's the saying that goes along with CSAR?
It's these things we do that others may live. That's the motto. And, you know, it's basically that sacred promise that, you know, you're going to do everything you can in your power to get, you know, the American soldiers, you know, out of the combat zone, home within the golden hour, so they have a higher probability of surviving. You know, very, very noble calling, in my opinion, probably the most in the Air Force.
No doubt. No doubt. I got goosebumps. I haven't had this many goosebumps on any of the guests we've had on here in quite a while. Holy cow. And these helos we're talking about, you guys aren't attack helicopters. I mean, you've got armament, but you're going in to rescue injured soldiers, correct?
Correct. Yeah. So the Pave Hawk helicopter I flew on, the H-860G, it was just like a 60, like you'd see like the Army guys, right? Like, but it would be kitted out with either a Gal 2 minigun or at the time a Gal 18, 50 cal. And then we had chaff and flares, and we had other stuff we could to find a survivor. And the whole mission really is personnel recovery type thing. Like the story of like when General Goldfein went down behind enemy lines and Colonel or General Kunkel, now, you know, those guys went and picked him up, you know. That's sort of the mission that it was made for, you know, but really, you know, we do a lot more CASAVAC than anything, you know, sort of like in our case, we had to do a CASAVAC mission.
And what does that mean?
But basically, like, I'll just tell a story here, but a CASAVAC is like, there's some sort of mass casualty going on or a couple, you know, a couple of injured guys, what we call CAT alphas. Basically you have an hour to get those, you know, those men and women back after they've been shot to the operating table. So they, have a higher probability of pass or making it, you know what I mean?
Right. That golden hour.
The golden hour, yep.
And how many machine guns are on one of these helicopters?
So we have one on the right side and one on the left side. So you have two total.
But I read in the book there where you had to have all four weapons up and running on a situation you guys went into. What's the four? Is that two helicopters?
Two helicopters, yes, sir. So we would have a what you call lead and trail. And we were leading, and you'd usually fly to the area in like echelon, like they're, let's say our 5 o'clock, right? Like flying with us. And then all this tactical stuff happens. Basically the JTAC had to mark the enemy with like purple smoke, and it was in the daytime. And that was another difference for me doing this in the day. And we basically had to do three or four gun runs with all four 50 cals in that targets on target in that tree line to sort of fight our way in a little bit there. And, you know, there was 12 Al-Shabaab in this tree line that had shot, you know, our Green Berets and our operators with mortars and their version of the Dishka as well. And yeah, man, it was a pretty nasty CASAVAC. And I always tell people we, you know, on June 8, 2018, we saw the best side of combat search and rescue, meaning we saved five guys. And then we saw the worst side were one Eagle, one American when he got back to the operating table passed. And that mission sticks with me, man. And I always tell people in aviating or this type of world, it's not what you do, it's what you don't do that haunts you. And so you always think about those guys didn't make it.
Yeah. Well, I you know, I'm sure you guys did everything possible to save that man. It's ultimately up to God. It's God's will.
Yeah. Yeah. And I struggled with that forever, man. Like, and you know, I was like, man, like, I asked God the question, you know, why does bad things happen to good people? And I still don't exactly know the answer to that. You know, I have an idea, you know, but, you know, I think God calls some people home earlier than others, and God gives his toughest battles to some of his warriors, you know, is the only thing I really come up with. But yeah, I still dabble with that question a lot, you know, so. But yeah, you know, it was unfortunate he got back to the operating table and passed, and, you know, there was a lot of things, like, in my mind, like, you know, the mind's a very powerful, tricky thing, you know, like you start asking yourself, like, if I'd have been there a minute earlier, 5 minutes earlier, all this stuff, right? But come to find out, it, you know, the person would have passed regardless. But yeah, at the end of the day, that's someone's brother, someone's son, someone's friend. And, you know, one of the Air Force core values is service before self. And I didn't know what that word meant till that day. So I'll say that.
Jeez. What a lesson. And you said that was Al-Shabaab in East Africa where that happened.
East Africa is June 8, 2018. And it was my one and only Casabec, you know.
And we'll come back to that in just a second, because I want to ask you, is in your book, you make reference to where the alert comes across, scramble, scramble, scramble. Tell us what that is like, because you see it portrayed in movies. What happens when that alert comes in?
Yeah, so this was what happened. So me and my buddy went to the talk, and we were holding down 7 days of a Casavac type alert. So, and with those 7 days, you eat when you can eat, sleep when you can sleep type thing. You do what you have to do. And we were in these tents there in East Africa. And I went to the talk, and I talked to the intel person, hey, is like, everything good? I'm going to take a tactical nap. Me and my buddy were like, yeah, okay, everything's good. We're going back. So as soon as I got on the top bunk, man, I hear attention on that scramble, scramble, scramble. Boom, you know, hit the ground, and I didn't need my radio no more. And I sprint to the helicopter. And so, you know, there's a saying, slow is smooth, smooth is fast. And that's going on in your mind. You're making sure you're not missing a checklist step, you know. And you've done this 100 times in training, you know. So I'll just go with a story here. We get there, we take off. I think it was 3 to 5 minutes. We get airborne, and we were in a right hand bank. So the left gunner, super experienced guy, and he really drove the fight that day. He had I think it was a Warren Cyrenos on his 50 cal. And basically when he armed it, like put it in the chamber and electrically armed it, right? Like there was what we call a runaway gun. So the gun's firing by itself, essentially uncontrollably. And I'm looking at the ground, and like, I see the impacts a little bit from the 50 cals because we're that close to the ground. And I was like, man, we just took off. Somebody's already shooting at us. And then I look over, and he had fixed it. He was fixing his runaway gun that time. And I had pulled the chaff and flare pins. And what those are is like, basically those, your chaff and flares are like, flares are big fireballs that protect you against surface air missiles. And water had gotten one of the CMDS panels. And like, when I took those pins out, it jettisoned every flare we had. I could literally feel the heat from the fireballs. The communication with the JTACs was intermittent. And at this point, I'm literally like, I think I even said on comms, like, what the F is going on? Cause all these different things are happening, that were not good. And then we get there, and then basically the JTAC said he wanted the close air support with a 50 cal rescue helicopter, which is rare. And, there was those 12 guys in the tree line. And basically before we could land on this dirt road, there were still tracers going both ways. We had to suppress the enemy and 3 or 4 gun patterns. We had 2 aircraft, 2 guns each, all rounds on target, and, 3 or 4 gun runs. And we were the first to land. And I remember they bring in the first American. He was the guy that passed. They put him next to the ox tanks, and the PJ started giving him a tracheotomy. Then they put another Green Beret beside me, and they basically had an eye bandage on him where they had to wrap it. And then a partner nation guy who got shot in the gut, and he's coming towards the aircraft, and you know, his gut shot and stuff like that. And so we finally get everybody, and we take off, and we go right into the gun pattern again, start shooting again, while our brothers are on the ground picking up their cat alphas. And so we egress, you know, it seemed like a while, but, you know, in my mind, it's like forever, right? But it's like two or three minutes, right? And so we egress the area, and we get the guy's back. And then what had happened was the trail had one more guy they had to pick up, which, you know, was probably cat alpha, maybe cat, you know, bravo, something like that, a little lighter injury. So they had to get him picked up. And so we immediately, like, at that point, I'd seen what they had done to an American, you know, and I'd put gas and, you know, put all the bullets back in my ammo can, and immediately go to a gun pattern and start shooting. Probably shot half my ammo at that point, and just all rounds in this tree line. And they get their guy. We come back, and I'll never forget, man, that the experienced guy was like, he's like, you know, check the underside of the helicopter for bullet holes. And I was, you know, just that moment, like, man, we were that close to all this stuff, right? And then I come around the top of the aircraft, and the aircraft commander's there, and he had told me that, you know, American had passed, an Eagle had passed once they got to the operating table. And again, it hit me like a ton of bricks. And, you know, it's one of those things, like someone's brother, someone's son, someone's friend. And I'll never forget that moment when the 130 had to come down from up north and pick that guy up. And there was a casket made out of, I believe it was OSB board. They were trying to get enough OSB and plywood to make him a casket, right? And his brothers brought him on the aircraft. And I'll never forget. I learned what sacrifice was that day. And like I said, that is our nation's very best, man. And I truly believe that.
This episode of Unfiltered is brought to you by Google Gemini. U.S. college students get Gemini's Pro Plan free for 1 year and use the best model in the world for multimodal understanding. So whether you're uploading a video to get feedback on your presentation, uploading a photo of your homework to ask for extra help, or transcribing notes from a lecture you missed, Gemini 3 Pro can help. I'm honestly so happy and excited for all the college students out there because I wish this was around back when I was in school. This is such a game changer and so useful. I'm honestly a little jealous. So if you want to try it out, sign up to get more access to Google's most accurate model, Gemini 3 Pro. Unlimited image uploads, pro-level image editing, higher limits in Notebook LM, Gemini in Gmail and Docs, 2 terabytes of storage, and more. All you have to do is visit gemini.google/students to learn more and sign up. Terms apply.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Ugh, fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
This episode of Unfiltered is brought to you by Google Gemini. U.S. college students get Gemini's Pro Plan free for 1 year and use the best model in the world for multimodal understanding. So whether you're uploading a video to get feedback on your presentation, uploading a photo of your homework to ask for extra help, or transcribing notes from a lecture you missed, Gemini 3 Pro can help. I'm honestly so happy and excited for all the college students out there because I wish this was around back when I was in school. This is such a game changer and so useful. I'm honestly a little jealous. So if you want to try it out, sign up to get more access to Google's most accurate model, Gemini 3 Pro. Unlimited image uploads, pro-level image editing, higher limits in Notebook LM, Gemini in Gmail and Docs, 2 terabytes of storage, and more. All you have to do is visit gemini.google/students to learn more and sign up. Terms apply.
You mentioned Eagle. What does that mean?
Eagle's it's like what we'd say on the aircraft comms for like an operation going on, like an American, and like Falcon okay. would be like a partner nation.
Okay.
And then a Crow would be a guy that's a bad guy.
So obviously that had a detrimental effect on your psyche, one that you had not experienced before. How did you handle that?
Not good, honestly. You got back and I wanted to go back to gunships because the end of my career was sort of ending, 2020 was my 20 year mark. And I wanted to deploy on my last, my anniversary essentially. And I got to do that the July of 2020. That was so slow. Nothing's going on, man. And I'd felt like my whole sense of purpose, it was coming to the end, right? That sense of relevance was gone, then the mind, I get back, I start, what was a weekend drinking habit turned into like a pint a night just to go to sleep, and mixing it with sleeping pills, you name it, man. I was doing that, unfortunately. And, my wife, when I get back and I'm approaching the 21st year, right? And she's like, hey, you're not all right. It's either me or your daughter or the bottle. And I'm thankful. I'm so glad that God led me to choose my family, And mm-hmm. I did that and I started getting what you call prolonged exposure therapy through a USOCOM psychiatrist.
And then you're still in the military as this is going on?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, it's my last, right at my last year mark.
Before we get into that, you were in 2019, you suffered an injury. Is that correct?
I did, yeah. I tore my pectoral major.
And was that in combat?
It was actually doing training in a combat area. So it was nothing sexy or cool. We're basically the currencies you have to keep up. And one of those is like a night water. Basically, you're dropping the PJs off in the ocean. You come back and hoisting them up and fast rope on the man, hoisting them up again, basically to stay current in case we had to do something in that area. And what it was the first PJ I picked up, and I remember too, is the first time I'd ever used like the white phosphorus MVGs, and we get in the spray and dip his fins, pick him up, And then the other, I had two on there for the last part of it. And I didn't dip their fins to where it like stabilized the cable. So you get what you call the pendulum effect, and it goes out, and I could, it sounded like bubble wrapping, the helicopter popping. And somehow, I don't know how, man, I finished this hoist, and I go to clear my 50 cal, I pop the top cover before we land in the fob. And I was like, my arm's not working. And my buddy's like, what do you mean your arm's not working? And we got back, the PJs cut my sleeve off, and they could see how it manifested sort of was this huge pump knot on my bicep that was like black and blue. Like it had bled that way. And when you tear your pectoral major, it sort of winds up like a, you ever had a backlash on a fishing reel? It was like that, but it like comes up like that. And so it all bled out in my arm, and they got me to, in the end, they got me to Langsdorf, Germany for a few weeks. And then I got my surgery when I got back to America for that. So, yeah,
it doesn't sound like a lot of fun.
I
didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
I was saying it was, and it was one of the things that was my fault, and I knew it was my fault, but I wanted to get back up and fly again especially before I got out. And I knew probably the best thing for me to do would be to go back to home, right, in the gunships at that point, and so I could do that last deployment on my 20-year mark. So,
yeah. You mentioned your wife. With all this going on, how in the world do you have time to find a wife?
So, funny story. This was in, 2014, 2015. I'd got back from a deployment, and one of your previous guests actually mentioned Portales, New Mexico, the other day, and my wife was going to college there in Eastern New Mexico University, and I'd been back, a few hours and stuff, and my buddy's like, hey, like, you want to go play basketball and at this, this college gym? And I was like, yeah, basically, it was more about the girls than it was the basketball, because we were going to barbecue after that and stuff. And we get there, and I noticed her sort of her swagger, I guess you'd say, her attitude. Like I grew up around the Eastern Band of Cherokee Nation, and there were certain terminologies that a lot of Native Americans use, and it's illustrated on that new show, Reservation Dogs. But she would say things like "scode in," as in "let's go then," or "let's do this," as in "let's do this." Basically, creative, quick ways of saying those words. And just we were walking across this, basically this bridge that goes over across the highway, and to back to the college dorm and stuff. And I'm asking her, "Hey, like, would you happen to be Native American?" And she just smiled. And at that point, not to sound like a hopeless romantic or anything, but when you know, I always tell my wife, I'm still hopeless, but I'm also a romantic, so she, she put me in the friend zone for, I felt like forever, but I eventually climbed out of it with, perseverance, and she gave me a chance, and still the best thing that's ever happened to me.
And you guys have children?
Yeah, we have actually my daughter's about to be 9 years old on November 21st, Sullivan, which, when my wife got pregnant, I was going through my 60 training at that time in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I remember thinking like, well, she's probably going to have dark eyes. And Sullivan is the old Gaelic, old Irish term for dark eyes. And that's why we gave her that name. So
very cool.
Thank you.
I'll be honest with you. I was not aware of the Scottish influence there in Western North Carolina until I read about it in your book.
Oh, yeah.
I know my grandmother on my mom's side immigrated from England. So we know we've got the English heritage. And of course, then Murphy, you just presume it's Irish. But my daughter-in-law did some research, and she thinks we're Scottish rather than Irish.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's
why even am I bringing that up? I don't know.
There's a Murphy, North Carolina, actually. They like Boone, that area. It's called Murphy, North Carolina. Yeah, there's a lot of Murphys around.
Yep. I was stationed in Greensboro after I came back from South America. Spent some time over in that area. When you got back, so that injury was in 2019,
right?
You got out at the end of 2020,
2021, December
2021. And from the time of your injury until you got out, is that when the attack was against Al-Shabaab there in East Africa?
No. So that was 2018. I'm talking about with the Casavac mission. That was June 8th of 2018. Was that a Casavac? And then I did one more trip to East Africa when the injury happened in 2019, the same area.
So when you came back, that's when things had changed.
Yeah.
You're not going on the missions like you were.
Yeah. There was a lot of trauma with that. And just like my sense of purpose, and I'd injured myself and I wasn't flying at the time. Right. Cause I'm trying to get back up to flying status and working with, there's this program called Preservation of the Force and Family. And I actually had, she's actually one of the Olympic dive teams, physical therapist now, but her name is Lori, man. And she put me through it, man. But she's like, like, if you want to prove that flight doctor wrong, you're going to have to, you know, put blood, sweat, and tears right here. And she got me back up to flying status. And I remember messaging her when the flight doc, you know, said, yeah, you can fly again. And at that point, you know, I wanted to go back to gunships because that helicopter, that's a young man's game, you know, and I'm getting older at that point too. So,
yeah. Yeah. We hate to admit it, but that does happen.
Oh, yeah.
So when did you start getting therapy? Is that when you finally transferred back to the United States permanently, or are you getting it while you're in country in Africa, or how did that happen?
So we had started that trip 2020 July, you know, to Iraq, Al Asad, Iraq, and but did absolutely nothing but, you know, droning around, right, circles in the sky. I think we may have shot once in like 90 days, and you know, I get back, and I had talked to a chaplain over there at one point a little bit, but you know, I got back, and then that's when the drinking really, I mean, 2020, just, you know, beer after beer, liquor after liquor. You know, I was in this vicious cycle, man, where like I would get home from work, you know, and I would just, as I'm going through the door, shotgunning some liquor, you know, and just a very, anybody's ever experienced alcoholism at that level, like, I feel for you if you've got that bug, man. It's a very hard thing to do. But, you know, and that's when my wife and even my friends noticed, like, man, like, you're not all right, you know, and, you know, she gave me that ultimatum, and I'm so glad I chose her and my daughter. And I went to see a USOCOM psychiatrist, and she gave me what she called prolonged therapy exposure, and say, okay, we're going to get to the root cause, and we're going to get to where you can write this out over and over and over. Talk about it sort of like we're doing now. First time I told her the story, I cried. Heck, the psychiatrist cried. And since that day, she's like, you know, you should tell your story. And I said no 100 times, man. And once I got out, you know, and nothing, doing nothing, like, man, like if one person gets help from reading this book and gets help, then that's a blessing, that's a win. And that's sort of two reasons I wrote it, was to show the rest of America, hey, this is what goes on when you're sleeping. Number two is to say it's okay not to be okay. We're just wrapping up 2 decades of war.
It sounds like this has given you a purpose again.
Oh yeah. Yeah. But writing therapy, and one of my other podcasts, I heard the guy say, like, helping is healing in a way. Paying it forward, you feel a lot better about it. And like I said, that sense of identity, that's the most common feedback I get from a lot of emails, texts, and like, that's a real thing when that's gone, especially on that gunship, when you're not doing those cool guy missions anymore and making sure those guys get home and that's over. That's when, like, those demons surface and you have to keep them at bay.
Man, I mean, first of all, thank you for your service. And I don't mean that to sound cheesy at all. I do that out of honor and respect for you. Just to continually put yourself in harm's way like that, where there's active combat going on, and then when things calm down, you're like, oh, I'm not getting any action, so I'm gonna quit, or I'm done here. You know, I want to do something else. It kind of defies logic, unless you've been in the situation and you've experienced it and you understand what the feeling of that is, and the feeling of trying to help others. You know, I don't think that you join the military, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think you join the military for the specific purpose of killing people.
No, not at all. And to be honest, it was never really about that. And, you know, and don't get me wrong, the gunship, that is your mission, is to, you know, you're going to get lots of enemy killed in action. But the part that a lot of people don't see in these games and Hollywood and stuff like that is, you know, men and women get home because of your close air support and those letters, you know. And like I said, when you get older, you know, you look at those letters a lot different. When that Ranger makes it back home to his baby girl, right? Like, you understand that when you have a family.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, it's 21, December 21, you're out of the military, you're going through therapy. How long is that something that's still going along? Here we are in late 2025, or did you reach a point where you're like, okay, I'm good?
So I continued my therapy long after the, I got out with the VA, you know, and sort of the same prolonged exposure. I still didn't want to do medicine, but then at one point I gave in, and, you know, I did the basically 3 different medications now for that stuff. But it, I'd be lying if I said the medication didn't help. You know, I think it does help, and it was a pride thing to me to be like, you know, I don't know if it's a mountainism or whatever, where I can overcome this by myself, you know. And to be honest with you, Steve, like, faith had a huge part in all this. And I don't believe I say this enough. It's like, I had turned to everything else but God and Jesus. But when I did, man, he showed me that light and helped me get back up.
It's not funny, but that's just the way you say it. It's funny how the people that we come on here, that we bring on here, that are Christians, and whether it's that foxhole Christianity or I've really realized that, hey, I couldn't have done any of this by myself. It's just amazing. Javier and I have been doing public speaking for pretty much since we retired out of DEA in 2013, traveling around the world. And I used to be hesitant to mention my faith. And finally, I realized that it was amazing how many people would come to me after a show and say, hey, thank you for mentioning your faith, because people need to hear that. And now I mention it and I don't care. It's because I know it's not me. Even the success of this podcast is not me. It's because I feel like this is what the good man upstairs has for me to do right now. And that's to give an opportunity for our listeners to hear heroic stories, to hear what other people go through. But I love it when people do profess their faith here on the podcast, because I think it says in the Bible, if you deny me, I'll deny you.
Right.
So it's funny too, because you look at the Bible, I refer to that as the instruction book, because just about anything you're going through, check it out, man. You can find some solutions in there, things that you should do. It's not just a history book.
Oh yeah. And I think, one of my favorite quotes is, and I realize this now, is like, God will put you back together in front of those who broke you. And I like to say he'll put you back together in front of what broke you, what vice got you, and like I said, in my faith, that line of view, he's got it all, man.
Yep. I listen on my podcast or on the Patreon channel. I have a monthly Q&A where people can write in questions, and I haven't turned down a single question they've asked me yet. And frequently I'll get the question, well, what's my favorite music? I like pretty much most music. I'm not into opera and things like that, but in my truck, I usually have the Christian radio station on, except when my wife's in there, and then she'll switch it over to her music. I keep threatening to smack her hands, but she smacks back, so I probably won't. But just a few weeks ago, I heard on the Christian radio station, the DJ said, how you feeling today? Just keep this in mind. You woke up today. That means God has more plans for you. He's not done with you yet.
Oh, yeah.
And I was heading to the gym. It's like 6:30 in the morning, and I'm thinking, wow, that just makes a whole lot of sense. So it's, I'm getting older here and things are hurting, and I go get my annual checkups, and now I'm going to see specialists for all my aches and pains. I went through physical therapy this morning for my hip, and it's just killing me right now as I'm sitting here.
Oh, yeah.
But the alternative is death.
Yep.
So I'm good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I always like to say, hey, how's it going? I was like, well, I'm still vertical. So I'm happy. I'd be lying if I was to tell you I was a good example for Christian. Like, I've lived a very carnal life in those years, especially before. I did a lot of things I'm not proud of because of alcohol and all this stuff. But at the end of the day, man, when that curtain comes down on the stage, man, I know where I'm going. So there's a lot of happiness in that thought, and just relief in that thought.
It is. And if you look at it, I mean, look how God has blessed you with a wife and a child.
Oh, yeah.
That you adore, that you chose over alcoholism.
Yeah,
I mean, man, you got a lot to live for, and the things that you've got going on now. One thing that I want to ask you about is this: there's some award that you got, the Air Force's Jolly Green Rescue Mission of the Year Award in 2018. Is that from the Al-Shabaab attack?
It is. Yeah, we got that from Secretary of Air Force Barbara Barrett. You got to meet her and stuff like that. And it was basically the way it's written is the most, I guess, noble or important rescue mission of that year, but it was the whole crew, and then the PJs got it as well. And it was a very, very humbling moment. And I got to meet, people like Chief Wayne Fisk, Vietnam rescueman legend. He went over the Green Feet tattoo a lot and stuff. Like, he's a really awesome guy, but yeah, it was, like I said, the combat search and rescue, those men and women were the very best, the best of me, and they made me better.
Well, and then you're part of that team, man. So don't minimize your participation in there. Somebody's got to get them in, and somebody's got to get them out. I think I'm in awe or shock. I'm not sure what the proper word is to describe listening to your story. And first responders and military go through a lot of dangerous situations, and I'm not minimizing anything that I was involved with, but I don't know that I could do what you did. People tell me that. I don't know that they could do what I did. I don't feel like I did anything. I just went and did my job.
What I was telling you earlier, I mean, I couldn't imagine being in the situations you were in. Thank you for what you've done for this nation, man. It's a safer, cleaner nation because of what you and Javier Pena did. I hope you get that often.
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that. I really do. It's kind of embarrassing, to be quite honest with you.
Sorry, man.
So, again, ladies and gentlemen, I'm holding the book up, but you're also going to see where you can get this book. It's Moonchild, The Roots and Wings. Oh, wait, I want to ask you one more question. The Roots and Wings of a U.S. Air Force Combat Special Missions Aviator. But you make mention of that term, roots and wings. What is that all about?
Yeah, so I think it's important to keep the morals and values that your roots instilled in you, and like never forget where you come from. But it's also more important to know where you're going. And the Air Force, it gave me that, like I said, that option to reach out and touch the face of God. So,
wow, that's good stuff. Good stuff.
Thank you.
What are you doing now in retirement or from the military?
So actually, I took a job doing the flight simulator stuff here at Canada Air Force Base, and I get to build scenarios for the AC-130 crews, and then the MCJ crews, and then the U-28s, and basically emergency procedures, weather problems, enemy shooting at them, all these different things we do virtually. And it's I'd like to get you down here sometime and put you in a simulator, man. It'd probably blow your mind, but basically millions-dollar video games. I hate to say it like that, but it's really what it is, and you're training these air crew members, these air commandos.
Oh, I'd love to do it, but I'd probably pee my pants. I'll be honest.
You're good, man. You'll be all right.
And one thing I want to ask you also, our readers, if you can see the size of this book, you know, I told you yesterday when I got this book in the mail, I thought, was it somebody put water on this and it shrunk? But what's the idea behind having a book of this size?
Yeah, so that was actually my publisher, Robbie Grayson's idea, a really creative guy, and he basically wanted it to be something like a checklist. In air crew, we're always using checklists, and something that could easily fit in your flight jacket or flight suit.
I love it. You would talk about a unique idea. It's a great idea. So before we finish up here, and I ask this of every guest, do you have any final words of wisdom or thoughts about advice maybe that you'd offer anybody that's considering a military or first responder type career?
I would say that you're definitely going to fall down. Talked about my first flight there, and a lot of times these air crew instructors, there's certain things in combat they can't simulate, and you realize that after the fact. And a lot of these are jobs you never want to have to do, but at the end of the day, you want to be the man or woman to go get these guys out of a bad situation. So just fall down 7 times, get up 8. And if I could sum it up in 2 words, I would say perseverance. And then the key to success in anything is repetition.
Great words of wisdom and advice there. I love what you said earlier, service over self. That just kind of sums it all together. I mean, 3 simple words.
And that's it's one of the 3 Air Force core values. And like I said, it took me a while to truly know what that meant. So,
yep. So for our listeners, listen, if you're experiencing any type of traumatic event, anxiety, stress, and you don't know where to turn, maybe you weren't in the military, you don't have the VA opportunity, there is a nationwide crisis hotline here in the United States. Just dial 988. There's somebody on there, 724, 365. They speak multiple languages. The person that answers that phone might not be the counselor that you're going to talk to, but they will find you somebody. The whole idea here is that you don't have to suffer through any of this alone. There is somebody waiting to help you. Okay. Certainly don't consider the suicide route, the alcoholism, the drug addiction, all the other ailments and the evil things that are out there. To me, the enemy is the devil, and they will tempt you. So 988. It's that simple. Okay. Anthony, where can people find you on social media here before I let you go, brother?
Yeah, no problem. So Instagram, it's Marco_Brolo21. And then the Facebook, there's just a page called Moonchild, and it's got me looking out the windows of my MBG on the gunship.
That's pretty cool. And the Marco, that's MARCO_Brolo is BROLO and the number 21.
Is there?
What in the world is that about? Sounds like Marco Polo that you play with kids in the pool.
Yes, I was sort of a smart aleck in my career a little bit, but you know, when the ISIS thing kicked off, it was advised at one point, like, you know, keep your low profile, social media, pictures of you holding 105, stuff like that, and And so I was named Marco Brolo as in Marco Polo. You know, sort of cheesy, but yeah.
I like it. And we discussed this offline also. Hopefully he'll have a website up here before not too much longer. And who knows? I mean, this might just be the beginning of your writing career. You know, the book is excellent. I'll tell you, it's excellent.
Yeah, I got something in the oven now I'm working on, and hopefully in a few months I'll get that out.
Well, brother, you're continuing to serve your country, and thank you again for your service. Ladies and gentlemen, you can find the book at Barnes & Noble. You can find it on Amazon, or you can go to the Game of Crimes podcast website. That's gameofcrimespodcast.com. Click on the little icon at the top says books. And when you go in there, you'll see all the books that all of our previous guests, since this show started, have produced or published, and his will be right at the top. All right, brother. Man, I'm going to go take a nap or something, because I got amped up on all this conversation. This is exciting. You truly are a hero. It's hats off to you. You put service before yourself, and you're continuing to do that by continuing to train those who are going to go over and put themselves in harm's way. So thank you, man. Thank you.
Well, thank you, brother. It's been an honor, Stephen. This is, like I said, I wanted this one since day one, man. Thank you for having me.
Well, you made my day. So, and my wife's going to edit this, so I hope she doesn't edit that part out, because bragging on Murphy a little bit. Nah, I can't thank her enough for everything she does to help me keep this show running.
Awesome.
But ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for continuing to come back every week. If you haven't seen us on YouTube yet, if you listen to this on the audio, go over to YouTube, do Murph a big favor, type in Game of Crimes Podcast in the search bar. When it pops up, hit that subscribe button, listen to a few episodes. If you like it, hit the like button. And if you've got some comments, send me those comments. I do read the comments, even the bad ones. In the meantime, you might want to go get some therapy yourself, because I don't know why you guys keep coming back every week. But actually, I do. Because you enjoy playing the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all. And that's the game of crimes. God bless you all. We'll see you next week.
This episode of Unfiltered is brought to you by Google Gemini. U.S. college students get Gemini's Pro plan free for 1 year and use the best model in the world for multimodal understanding. So whether you're uploading a video to get feedback on your presentation, uploading a photo of your homework to ask for extra help, or transcribing notes from a lecture you missed, Gemini 3 Pro can help. I'm honestly so happy and excited for all the college students out there, because I wish this was around back when I was in school. This is such a game changer and so useful. I'm honestly a little jealous. So if you want to try it out, sign up to get more access to Google's most accurate model, Gemini 3 Pro. Unlimited image uploads, pro-level image editing, higher limits in Notebook LM, Gemini in Gmail and Docs, 2 terabytes of storage, and more. All you have to do is visit gemini.google/students to learn more and sign up. Terms apply.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No.